there, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you things to make you live a more positively minded life. What an exciting week. What a very, very, very exciting week this is. Has been, will be, with the sun breaking through and the nice warm weather coming around, Sonny Rollins in the archive, and more of that coming up. By the way, we're going to be doing more interviews with great jazz artists, and we are doing many other things here on The Positive Mind. Today, what a privilege. One of my dearest, dearest creative people I know is with us. And she's going to talk to us today about the nature of art. Let me ask you a question about yourself. What is you, my friends? What is you? What is you? What is me? What is you? What is your first memory of doing something creative? Can you remember? Can you remember the first? Can you remember the first thing that was creative that was applauded of yours? Do you remember something of you, something that you did that was creative that was squelched by somebody? Pablo Picasso once said, everybody is born an artist. It's how to maintain that as you grow up that becomes a difficult task, or something like that. With me in the studio, Patricia Miranda. Patricia Miranda, welcome to WBAI. You've been a long-time fan here, huh?
Yes, long-time listener. Hi, Armand. Thanks so Hi much there. For inviting me.
Well, Patricia, do you think everybody's creative?
I do. I think everyone is creative. I think everything that we do every day just to negotiate life is a creative act. So everything we do is creative, and I believe we should all think of our lives that way, as everything we do being creative. We constantly make creative decisions throughout the entire day. I think artists just take that to a more focused place to create an object or a piece of music or a dance or something, to create a specific thing that manifests that energy in one place outside of the regular everyday things.
Life is like broccoli, Rob.
Life is like broccoli, Rob, yes.
Let's talk about you and life and broccoli, Rob.
Yeah, that's, well, broccoli, Rob, for those of you who don't know, is a beautiful vegetable. It's a dark green, leafy, bitter. It's a bitter green. So it's kind of a deep and lusty vegetable, which I love. I'm very passionate about broccoli rabe. And it's not something that I try and understand. I don't try and say, well, it has this vitamin or that vitamin. I just know when I eat broccoli rabe, I feel like I'm close to the source. I feel something essential. I feel like I'm consuming something essential, something earthy and beautiful. And I feel that way about art.
And so, was the last time you felt like you were eating broccoli rabe while involved in art? What about that Guggenheim? Did you see that?
The El Greco de Picasso exhibition at the Guggenheim is one example.
It's still there now, isn't it?
It's still there through.
Oh, we should tell people about that.
The end of March, yeah. It's a fantastic exhibition of Spanish artists spanning a very long time period from El Greco to Picasso. And there's Zurbarans, and there are Goyas, fantastic Goyas, and Picassos. And it's organized, rather than chronologically, it's organized by subject matter, so that you can have a Picasso hanging next to a Zurbaran, or a Picasso hanging next to a Goya. And so you see the artistic lineage, you see the inspiration, you see where they came from, where Picasso came from, and you see the connections between them rather than looking at art in a more linear way, which is the way we would learn it in school. But you can see how Picasso looked at the earlier painters. And those painters, such as Goya and Zurbaran, are incredibly passionate. The paint is just gorgeous. They're deep and thoughtful paintings. They're full of dark. They're very chiaroscuro, full of very dark areas and light areas. They're just amazing.
Paint is paint.
Paint is paint.
You mean paint is different? The paint they have is different than the paint you see normally?
Well, by saying that they love paint means that you can see a kind of a joy in the application of the paint. There's a beauty in the way that they apply
the paint.
How
do you see the joy of an application of paint. What do you see it in the stroke? Do you see it in the delicacy that it was put on? How do you see it?
All those things, I think.
Yeah, I know. These are now, of course.
I know, it's
okay,
a
here I
question.
Go. Sure, and I'm giving you a difficult question because I'm doing the very same thing that somebody did with Sonny Rollins. They said, can you describe what it's like to be creative? He said, no. They said, can you tell me what you're thinking when you're being creative? He said, no. He said, because I'm being creative. I'm not thinking. When you're doing art and you're applying that oil or that paint to canvas, are you thinking or feeling or both? Or do each person do it differently, and does one think and the other feels? And
I think everyone does it somewhat differently, but one thing that I would say is probably universal is that art is a way of bypassing the conscious mind, the part of us that wants to order things into neat little categories and understand it and dissect it and do that, and bypasses that to the unconscious, where you can express things that are not understandable in the normal everyday way.
What a wonderful thing for people to be free of having to understand.
That's right.
But they're so inhibited. Everybody's so inhibited about their work, about what they would do in painting or anything like that.
Well, we live in a time where we're desperately trying to comprehend and understand everything that's going on all the time. And we can't. So there are times where we over-order things. And so paintings in particular, I mean, all art does this, but paintings for me in particular, bypass that desire or need to order everything and allow me to experience something essential about human nature, about emotions, about understanding that I would never be able to articulate in words.
Patricia Miranda, as a teacher, and I know you are, as a speaker in the field of art, you travel all over, don't you?
Yeah.
You work at some of the universities. What do you do?
I do a lot of different, like most artists, I do a lot of different things. Most artists have 5 full-time jobs. We do lots of different things.
You run a gallery.
I run a gallery.
You teach classes. I know you also paint.
I also paint.
Have a couple of your paintings here at the DeMille Center, which have been just remarkable. Everybody's loved them because they're painted in that Japanese food, tempura. Egg tempura, right?
Yes, I use egg tempura. Not egg tempura.
Oh.
Tempura being the Japanese food.
My mistake, I'm sorry.
You're not the only one. People are always calling me up about my egg tempura paintings.
Egg tempura. I'm really kidding. I understand.
Yeah.
Egg tempura, I'm dying to get my hand on those in this thing. Let's describe what egg tempura is.
Egg tempura is...
Because people could be doing this at home today.
It's true. Well, yes. Egg tempura is an ancient medium. Going back to the Egyptians, they used egg tempura. Some of the Fayum portraits are egg tempura. And basically what it is the binder of the paint, which is what makes paint sticky, makes it stick to the page, is the yolk of an egg. So all paint has color source and binder. The binder is the glue, again, that makes it stick to the page. And the kind of paint is determined by the kind of binder. So the binder for oil paint is oil. It's basically color source and oil, and that makes oil paint. So tempera is a kind of a precursor to oil paint. It was used for thousands of years, and it's a beautiful medium. Challenging, exciting, very sensual, and I just love it.
You add egg to paint? You add paint to egg?
Well, the egg is an essential part of the paint. So you're not adding paint to it. The egg is part of the paint. So you have to take the yolk of the egg. You separate the yolk, and you do that by cracking the egg and pouring off the white and rolling the yolk into the palm of your hand. You roll it back and forth while drying your hand. Basically, that's removing the white. So when the yolk is sufficiently dry, because you only want the yolk, you don't want the white, you pick it up. You actually pick it up in your hands, and you pierce it, and the yolk falls through, and you mix with some water with that, and that's your binder. It's your binder, it's your medium, it's what you add your pigments or color source to.
Now, if you pick up a brush and you just pick up that egg right there and you paint with it, will you get color on a wall?
No. It'll be clear.
It'll be clear?
It'll be a little bit yellow when you first paint it, but the yellow of the yolk actually bleaches out.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
Okay, so it's clear until you add pigments to it.
Yeah, you add pigments, primarily mineral sources, some dye plants too, but primarily mineral sources. You have to mix the paint up fresh every single day Because you can't store it. It's egg
yolk. So this is that workshop you do that people talked about.
Yes.
Where people are fondling eggs.
Yes, exactly.
Right? You're an egg fondler.
That's right.
What do they do? I mean, they're rolling eggs.
They roll the yolks in their hands. They grind the colors in themselves, and they work with the paint. Yeah. It's a beautiful way for people to, whether you're an experienced painter or you've never picked up a brush before, it's a wonderful way to connect people to the creative process because it's a physical act. It's a wonderful way to engage you with the process. So if you are intimidated or you've never painted, you might feel, well, I don't know how to pick up a brush or whatever. But this gets you very intimate with your paint.
So you're rolling, you have a group of people who are
rolling
eggs through their hands. And when one of them meets the other one for the first time and they shake hands, they're like stuck together, right? So they have a new bound relationship, bound by egg.
Well, they do in the sense that most people who take my workshops run home and start telling everyone about how they rolled the yolks around that day.
So why? It's so exciting.
It's so exciting.
Well, is rolling the yolk like a beautiful experience because it's drying out in your hands and you're keeping the integrity of the yolk? It's not breaking, right?
Yeah, it's so amazing. It's such a delicate and yet powerfully strong little package. It's a life source, the egg. And also we live in a time where we're very separated from the sources of where things come from. We don't know where our food is grown always. We don't know who made our clothing. This is something that's important to me in the process. And so we don't know where our paint comes from. I mean, you'd probably find out where your food came from well before you found out where your paint came from. And so this is gets you right to the source. It connects you to the fact that everything that we do, everything that we have, everything that we create, everything that we use comes from the planet. And somebody had to take it from the planet. Some person, some human being had to take it from the planet and do something to it to transform it into something that you can use in your house, whether that's food or clothing. It doesn't matter. We don't have any place else to get stuff from except the planet. So it also has served as a way to connect people to the natural world, to develop an intimacy that they may not have. I live in Manhattan. My relationship to the natural world is different than someone who lives on a farm. However, through the processes that I use, I've become extremely intimate with animal and vegetable things that I use in my paints in a way that I never would have even conceived. You become sensitive to the smell and the feel, and when it's soft or wet or dry or creamy, and all of these things become extremely important.
This is Armand DeMille with Patricia Miranda. It's beautiful, isn't it? So Patricia, so a person who works with this with their hands, you're going to tell me that there are some paintings that I could look at now, and I would look at some old Egyptian paintings, and not only will I see the painter who painted it, but I'm going to see the chicken that laid the egg is going to be represented right there. There's a DNA of a chicken going back to Egypt.
Sure.
You know, you could probably dig up a DNA and you could track it, and then you could try to see if
they do that with the wood of panels,
sure.
Ancient panels. They try and determine where the tree came from and to see if panels belong together or not, stuff like that. You don't need to, when you look at art in a museum or whatever, it's not necessary to necessarily know what medium the artist used. It's very important to the artist. It's not necessarily important to the person. In other words, my paintings are not about egg tempera. They're contemporary paintings. It's not about the technique. However, it's a kind of a private integrity that I have with the paintings in the process of making them. Now, it's interesting for people to know, but I don't think it's not necessary to look at a painting. It's not necessary to know exactly how it was made. You can experience paintings on a very powerful level without knowing anything about how the artist made it as well.
So what makes one painting very dramatic and great to one person is not necessarily so dramatic to the next. I mean, a single line drawing, you know, a single charcoal sketch by Picasso can move me sometimes, just as, you know, something very complex will move me. How does a person get to know if they have good taste or not good taste when it comes to art?
Why one painting affects one person and doesn't affect another or affects them differently is one of the inexplicable mysteries of life, and it's the reason that art is so amazing and wonderful. It's not something that you can say you can put in a box. It's not something that you can contain, and it's going to have the same effect on everyone. It has different effects, so different people, and it's wonderful today because we have so many different artists working in so many different mediums and so many different forms that you can respond to so many different things. So
What do you want to teach people about art and working with art? Do you want to inspire the artistic in everybody?
I do. I don't want to teach people to paint like me. I don't want to teach people to like certain kinds of art over other kinds of art. I love all art. Isn't it Louis Armstrong said there's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music? So I respond to art in that way. And what I try and do is to inspire people to just stay with art a little bit longer than they might have naturally done, because it gives back a lot when you can do that. We're not necessarily trained to do that. We live in a culture where everything's very fast, you know, TV, and we're bombarded with images at a very fast rate. But art requires you to stop and to just stay with it. And a lot of people, if they haven't been trained to do that, are uncomfortable. They feel like there's something they should know. They feel like they should know which is good and which is bad and all of this. And I say, you know what, that doesn't matter. If you just stay with the work a while, just sit with it.
Sit with it meaning don't do anything, or sit with it, keep painting, sit with it, create it, sit with it how?
Well, if I'm talking about someone who's looking at a piece of art,
looking
for example,
at a piece of
right,
art, okay.
Just instead of, what happens a lot of times is you go in, you go, oh, I don't understand it, or I don't like it, or you just walk by. You look at it for about 2 seconds and move on to the next. And what I would ask people is to, that first reaction is fine, but to stay there a little longer. Sometimes paintings, they're slower. They need you to be with them. They will communicate.
Give me an example of a painting that you think people would get. I mean, like if you see water lilies, that's kind of easy, right? I mean, that's kind of a breeze. That's a knockout. Everybody sees it. Everybody gets it. If you see Chagall, you kind of get that right away. If you see, you know, this kind of extraordinary stuff.
Well, sometimes that's deceptive, because if you can stand in front of Monet's water lilies, and at first you say, oh, it's beautiful. It's water lilies. I get that. That's kind of that first mind understanding. But if you were to just stay there, past what I would consider maybe a comfort level, you know, a little longer than you think maybe you should, or a little longer than you might be inclined to do, and to see what happens. You might see something very different things about that painting that are not available at a first glance.
So it sometimes takes time to, you need to interact.
That's right.
What you're saying is interact with what's there. Is the nature of the fact that it's hanging on a wall in a museum automatically a testimony to the fact that it may have value? I mean, is that a pretty good, you know, you say, well, it's in the museum, so therefore I'm going to spend time with it?
Well, it means that it has gone through a process of being looked at by a lot of people and experienced. I'm not going to say that it means that every single thing in a museum is the highest quality work of art, but it does mean it's gone through a process that our culture uses to determine, you know, great works of art. But that's less important to me than understanding or just having your own reaction to things by just going in and standing in front of a painting longer than you feel you might otherwise do, and just see what happens. Now, it doesn't mean you have to have any particular reaction. You may not, and that's fine. The first thing, I think, is not to worry about what the reaction is, and to not worry that you're going to have some kind of intellectual understanding of what the painting is. You can say, oh, I get it now. And then, oh, I get it, now I can move on. That's not what paintings are about. They're about something a little bit more mysterious, a little bit more slippery. And that's what's important about them. Because if I could tell you in 2 sentences what I mean, that's not a painting. A great painting or great work of art of any kind keeps giving. Every time you come back to it, I mean, every time I listen to Bach, it gets better and better and better. I hear something different. I experience it in a new way. And great works of art always do that. And a great work of art can just be something that has that effect on you. I try not to have people worry about who's somebody else saying that this is a great work of art and this is not a great work of art.
But Patricia.
Yes.
Of all the things that you've seen and you've traveled a great deal, pick one, not that's your favorite, but pick one that knocked you so far out that you couldn't leave the field, and describe what you saw as you were looking.
There's so many, it's probably not time. Since I look at a lot of work, I have that effect. I have that reaction a lot.
But pick just one of those, you know, one of those rare, the ones that are known of you, like one of the museum pieces or something like that. Whatever knocked you out.
Well, I'll just use something I saw recently in the show at the Guggenheim that we were talking about. And it's a painting by Zurbaran, who's an amazing painter. And, of course, I had known about Zurbaran you know, he's in the history books, etc. But I guess I hadn't seen one in a while, or it could be just these paintings are so spectacular and they're contextualized so beautifully in this show that I walked by this Zurbaran, a painting of St. Francis it happened to be, and I just stopped me in my tracks, almost as if the painting had just, by its sheer existence, stopped me cold.
Hmm.
And I just had to stand there for a long time. I don't know how long it was. Could have been a few minutes, could have been an hour. I don't know. Time, suspense. And just look at this painting. I was just so struck by it.
What? Describe it to me. What did you see?
It's a large painting of St. Francis. He's in a robe with a hood over his head. And the Spanish paintings are so beautiful because they use light and dark very dramatically. So a lot of the painting is very, very dark. There's a whole darkness around him. And the darkness they use, it's beautiful. It's deep. It's not flat. It feels like you could fall into it. And he's looking down. It's a very large painting, so he's much higher than you are standing. And he's looking down at you, but his face is very nearly completely hidden by the hood of his robe. So at first, you almost don't even see that there's a face. It's very mysterious. And so I might have walked by and seen, oh, okay, it looks like kind of a freaky guy in a robe, you know. But if you stand there a little longer, things begin to reveal themselves to you about the painting. So his face is suddenly there. It's never fully there. It's always in shadow. But he's looking down. And there's a silence about this painting, which I think if I had to describe or pin down why it stopped me, and I hate to do that, but if I had to, I would say there's a kind of a visceral silence to this painting, a stillness, a quiet. And that stopped me. It had an energy that just reached out to me.
It has the energy, or it evokes that energy in you.
Probably both.
You know, so that's what you think. It's probably both. You never know what it is that'll make it happen inside you. But I think what you're talking about is similar to the experience of love. That in loving someone, in loving a person, or being with someone, you say, I love myself and the way I feel when I'm with you. When I look at your art, when I look at some of your paintings, I love the way I feel when I look at your paintings. Okay. Am I loving your painting? I'm not sure, but I love the way I feel when I'm looking at your painting. You know?
This is another reason why it's so important for people to actually really look at actual work rather than reproductions. Reproductions are wonderful. They get us to see art that we'll never actually physically be able to see. However, there is absolutely nothing like standing in the presence of an actual work of art. It has a physical energy of its own that doesn't translate in a reproduction. It just doesn't. There's the energy of the materials, the energy of the paint, there's the energy of whatever it is. If it's the music, seeing live music as opposed to recorded music. Both are wonderful, but there's nothing like the live thing.
Have you been to Rome?
I have.
Have you been to the, have you seen Michelangelo and mm-hmm. that stuff? Did that touch you that way?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
That thing, right, happens. You can see all the paintings you want. But when you look at those brush strokes and you look at, you know, you look at that and you see it right in front of you, it's all different.
Yeah.
What are the great museums we have in New York?
Oh, gosh, there's so many.
Well, there are so many.
There are so many. We're so blessed. We are so blessed in New York.
Name some of them.
The Metropolitan Museum, of course, is my personal favorite. And I've been there hundreds and hundreds of times. And every time I go there, it's whether I'm revisiting favorite wings or favorite paintings or favorite sculptures or whatever, it's almost as though I've never been there before because it's a new experience every time. The Guggenheim is a wonderful museum. And they show such a range of work from contemporary to, you know, historical. The Frick Museum is another one of my favorites.
Unusual. People don't know the Frick.
It's one of my favorites.
It's a secret.
It's not a tiny museum, but relative to some of the others, it's a small, intimate. It's a very intimate because it was the Frick Mansion, and they have this beautiful collection of paintings. So it's in the setting of a home, a grand home, albeit, but it's a home. And so it's a very intimate place to see work, and they have a beautiful, beautiful collection. And it's different than just a white wall with a painting hanging on it. There's furniture, you know, it's a home. So it's a very grand home, but it's a home. So you see paintings in a different context, a much more intimate context. The Morgan Library is another amazing museum where you can see lots of medieval manuscripts in particular, but many different works. Gosh, there's so many. I'm gonna
and there are so many. There are Russian. There's
the Natural History Museum. Even I mean, that's natural history, but still, there's so many amazing art pieces in there because the way that they organize the displays are done so artistically to communicate so much about our history as human beings.
So being a painter and being an artist is something that you've dedicated yourself to, and we want to learn how you teach this. I want to see, as we come back from our break a little later, I want to understand what the meaning of your teaching is and what it is that your students get, because I've seen some remarkable things, you know, especially in you and your dedication. I must say that you're one of those people who I know as an artist, you're so dedicated, everything comes secondary to it, that it's what you are. You are an artist. You are truly an artist. You make a living at it. You do your thing, albeit a small, meager living, as most people who paint
that
do.
I think when you dedicate your life to being an artist, and there are a lot of artists, everything in your life becomes an aspect of that art.
I think most people, you know, most great artists got discovered after they died. So it may be a good time, you know, wait until you die to start painting. Because then your art will really sell, don't you think? This is Armand DeMille with you with the Silly Mind and the Positive Mind. Hey, those of you who donated money to WBAI during the last marathon, we want to thank you very much. But for those of you who dedicated money or donated money for the film Home, H-O-M-E, do not wait for us to send you anything, because you're going to pick up your tickets at the theater, which is BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Try to get there at 7 o'clock on Thursday, March 1st, because that's the thing that's going to happen. We are seeing this movie called Home. Did you see this one yet, Patricia?
I haven't seen it yet.
But you're going to be there this one, right?
I'm going to try.
Okay, so it's going to be homethemovie.com. You could see it. And there is still, you probably could still call the Brooklyn Academy of Music and see if there are any tickets left and available. There's going to be a crowd from WBAI, well over 100 people. And I'm going to lead some kind of a thing to get people together. But do not wait. I mean, you'll be going down to the theater at 7 o'clock, and you'll be picking up your tickets there. They'll have your name online. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. That's number one. Number two, other announcement of the day is that we have a we are strongly looking for possibilities of anybody you know who you could recommend. We're trying to develop a list of people that are successful practitioners. People that people like. And I love the idea that if you love somebody and you say, I have the very best accountant, you could send me that name. The best accountant is, the best lawyer is, the best somebody is. We're starting to collect names of what other people in the audience recommend, of people that you like Victor Zines was just on The Dentist, was just on the radio. You like Victor? Send me a note telling me about your favorite practitioners, people who do different things, because I'm going to develop a registry. And even have something like, you know, here's how this person is rated. You know, here's five people who liked it. Send me the ones you like, send me the ones you don't like. So we're going to be putting that together as we develop one of our new research programs here. We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to teach you a little about rolling around with the eggs, my friends, with Patricia Miranda. This is Armand DeMille. Patricia Miranda, my guest, artist, teacher, and does a bunch of other things. Patricia, people, you try to teach people to work with art, and they're inhibited. What are the inhibitions that people normally feel? What are they afraid of?
I think the most prominent thing that people are afraid of is they believe that artists are born, not made. That somehow you just come out of the womb drawing and painting. And the truth is that artists work incredibly hard. They work incredibly hard. It's 97% perspiration, as they say. They work incredibly hard to focus their energy and to explore their vision and to train themselves in their medium. And most people feel like if they can't draw something immediately, there's something wrong. And I always say, well, if you had to play the piano, you know, you have to learn how to play the piano before you can
become... Do you think that you could teach anybody to be able to draw in a way that's satisfactory to them? Do you think that you can teach that?
Well, it might be presumptuous to say that I could teach anyone, but I think that anybody can learn. Yes, I think that anybody can learn. Different teachers will respond, different people will respond to different teachers, but I do think that everybody can learn to be creative in an art form, you know, paint or draw or dance or whatever.
But if you're working with somebody around paint, mm-hmm. have you ever had anybody saying, that's it, I just can't do it, I'll never touch a brush again?
No.
No, okay, so something you must do must change that experience.
Well, I hope what I do is encourage people to, first of all, feel comfortable to explore, to make mistakes, to not feel that they have to make a masterpiece. One of the things I always say in the Egg Temper workshop, because it's a very different medium, and even experienced painters can struggle with it because it's unique. It's different from other paints. And there's a lot of preparation involved, and so people can get very precious. And I say, well, you know what? It's just a 12 by 12 piece of wood. We work on a wood panel, usually. It's just a 12 by 12 piece of wood. Worst thing is, you throw it away. I mean, that's it. To encourage people to be willing to make mistakes and to just explore the medium, to explore their own creative expression, not worry so much about the final result in the beginning.
But if a person doesn't have imagination, you know, and I know people who don't. I know people who just don't know how to repeat things, and they don't know how to create something new or extrapolate or something like that.
It's very difficult to create something from nothing. I don't think that people realize how hard it is to create something from nothing, which is essentially what artists do. But I would say that I don't think that anybody doesn't have imagination, but if you can't access it, you can copy. You can copy. And this is the way that artists were taught throughout history. It's only very, very recently that we've developed a bias against it. So I always encourage people, if they've never painted, that they might find a painting that they love and copy it. It never ends up being exactly the same. We're not talking about a photographic reproduction. We're talking a way for you to engage your creative spirit that kind of bypasses the mind. So if you're copying someone else's painting, that intimidation, that worry about whether or not it's going to be a good image is taken away. And you can just let yourself experience the process of painting. It's a beautiful way to learn. It's a beautiful way to learn, copying.
You're a lovely person, and you're the kind of person who would engender in somebody a feeling of your acceptance. But I imagine when a kid goes to art school or his first class, where they teach him arts and crafts, I think, it's pretty brutal what takes place among the children, isn't it? I mean, there's so much damage done at those early years. I remember once I made, bookends. I made bookends. And I made these bookends and I dipped them in glitter. Because after I made them, I said, oh, they'd look really good dipped in glitter. And I remember the teacher telling me how I ruined it because I put it in glitter. And that they weren't good bookends anymore. And so I never made any bookends after that to this day.
It's true that the most...
I'm going to go back.
It's time bookends. To make some bookends. Armin.
Time to make some new bookends.
Well, I think that the most damaging thing that people can do with children, and I do programs with children as well, is to not allow them to make mistakes, which is basically what you're saying. Now, I might not have considered your glitter to be a mistake, but if they were trying to get a result and the child finds a new way or a different way to do it, that's an exploration. And in order to be creative, you have to be willing to make mistakes, to take risks, and to ruin something or to come up with something that's completely different than what you expected.
But, Patricia, you know, I've seen so often you'll see a kid will come in, and he'll smear some brown stuff on a piece of paper and bring it home to his mommy and say, Mommy, Mommy, look. And Mommy says, oh, how wonderful. Let me frame it. Is that good?
Yes, that's good. That is good.
You think it's good to encourage somebody who did something that really didn't have anything except just the effect of no effort whatsoever? I mean, do you think it's good to reward even things that may not be okay?
Well, I think it depends on the context. If it's a young child, then yes, that just throwing that paint on the paper is an expressive creative act, and that should be encouraged. Because if you said, well, it doesn't look like anything, or you criticized it, then that might be, you know, it's like the bookends. Make the child feel like they're not creative. A lot of people are told, well, you're not creative or you're not an artist. And I don't think that's true.
So you celebrate all forms of art.
I do. Of course, when you're training, you're moving along in time and you're older and you're training to really learn some skills as an artist, then obviously the work needs to be critiqued and all of that and talked about. But that's different than just a pure creative expression, which I think should be encouraged, especially in children.
Excellent. It's Patricia Miranda. Patricia, by the way, where is your class held?
The class is held in my studio in Port Chester.
Port Chester.
Yeah, which is in Westchester County. It's a block from the Metro North train station, so it's very convenient.
And it's a class that, what do? You spend a weekend with eggs?
Yeah, basically it's a three-day workshop where we do everything from preparing the panels with a rabbit skin glue, gesso. We use all the natural materials, and we make the paints. We do the whole thing, soup to nuts. It's really fun.
And then they create a painting?
And we spend time painting. And
where do you sleep?
Well, the workshop
it's
is just
days,
during the
yeah.
day.
People
go home.
They
go home, yes. Or if they come, I've had people travel and they'll stay in a local hotel or something.
Is there anything about the group process that's any better than an individual process? When you have a group of people working together, does one peek over and compare themselves? You know, they compare, well, your line is straighter than my line.
The group dynamic is wonderful. Wonderful. I taught a class recently where we had a group of all professional artists, people who'd been working, you know, a long time, not people who'd never picked up a brush before. And there was just a wonderful, all different, very different artists. There was a wonderful dynamic created between them. They all got to see, everybody approached it a little differently. So you learned from looking at other people's work. You learned about the technique and you learned about the process. And you were inspired by other people's work. And they're small classes, so there's an intimacy there. It's wonderful. It's a lot of fun.
You spend your life giving to people in this way. I also know you spend your life giving to a number of other causes. You're very involved with St. John the Divine, aren't you?
Yes.
How are you involved in that?
I'm involved in that in many ways. It's my spiritual home. It's a wonderful place.
Nice place.
It is a very nice place. It's a place that believes that God doesn't exclude, so everyone is welcome, and that's extremely important to me. They are very proactive about it. They embrace a lot of issues of justice, economic justice and peace and the like. They care about the arts. They express the spirit in a way that I feel is very meaningful. It's very meaningful. So I do a lot of things there.
And what kind of things do you do there?
Let's see. I do.
I mean, do you help them?
I've led some workshops there.
Using
art as a kind of a form of prayer. I've done that. I've served on committees. I've done, you know, many different things. I'm involved in the healing ministry there where we do the actual laying on of hands. And that's a wonderful.
How much do you get paid for this?
I don't get paid for that.
You don't get paid for that. I knew you would say that.
I couldn't get paid for that.
Okay, now you don't get paid for that. And there you are putting that stuff out because that's just as much part of your work as the painting is, isn't it?
I guess it is. Thank you for pointing that out. Well, it's wonderful. It gives back a lot to me, so I feel that it's right for me to give back.
You know, one of the things we were looking at recently, we were looking at some of the causes of happiness and depression, and we found that the people who find just what you described are the people most likely to be the least depressed. In other words, if you have a place to put it, you know, if you have something you believe in, and if you volunteer time, you give time, not looking to get back for it, and you give it to something you believe in, it does wonders for the spirit. And I think both everything you're talking about, the working with the different mediums and doing the painting, plus your active work, which is partially political, religious, a whole bunch of stuff, and I think you keep your head very well balanced by doing this, and I think you're a contributor, Patricia, because I think when you help people, I think they pick up your spirit. You're one of the smilingest persons I ever met. I mean, you have a genuine internal smile. Is there a photograph of you on your website?
There is, yeah.
There is. And that's right. I remember there is one with that smile. You have this, like, real thing that goes on inside you. There's a real person home. It's beautiful to see.
Thanks, Armand.
You know, one of the what's the opposite of creativity?
I would say unconsciousness. Being unconscious.
So, therefore, creativity is consciousness?
In a way, yeah, it is.
Describe that to me, would you?
I mean, I think that even if you're unconscious, you're probably creative because it requires creativity to function in the world. It's a difficult world. I think it requires creativity just to function. But I think when you're able to be aware of that, you become connected to something that's larger than just yourself. You become connected to the people around you. You become connected to the people that came before you, and you become connected to the people who will come after you. You become connected to the planet. So when you feel connected, you care about these things, you're going to be much more conscious about the way you step forward in the world. You know, the footprint you make, how you affect the people around you, how you use the precious resources that we have. I think that's an act of consciousness, and the more creative you are, the more conscious you can be. I don't want to say that, you know, just because you're creative, you're conscious. That's a bit of a leap, but it certainly can help, because being creative requires you to be very focused and completely present in the moment. When you're creating a work of art, you're so present in the moment that you're probably unaware of it. You're unaware of time, because it's about that moment, and it's an incredible kind of focus. And that's why I think everybody should try to find some creative thing that they can do, because that focus is amazing and it serves a lot. It's like if you meditate every day or something like that, it can be akin to that. And it can give you a centering place in your life.
If you're a person who does find this part of your spirit, if you do find this creativity inside of you, we've got a little test that let me change the subject for a minute. We have a test that we do here when people first walk in. We have a word rank ordering system that tells us how people think. Very often we'll find the people who are the most concrete, sequential people, sequential thinking people who think in concrete terms, or even abstract sequential people, which are the people who think in abstract terms, but they tend to put things in order. They try to make sense out of everything. We find that their creativity score is minimal. And you could see that somewhere somebody said to them that their creative mind doesn't count as much as their logic, as making sense out of things. And making sense out of something is what matters the most, and they lose this creative bend. The number of people that I have seen that I've sent back to their early childhood instrument, to the thing they used to do, to whatever they used to play with, is phenomenal, because it's practically every consultation I do, I want to find out. One of the biggest ones is dance. People giving up dance. I mean, there's so many people, they love the movement of their bodies and their dance, and to take their dance and to strip themselves of it where they no longer dance around the house, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
So dance is a big thing, and painting and drawing, we all did it as kids. We sat at those board desks, and we had a little pen in our hand, and
that's
we would
right.
scribble. And whoever encouraged those books, whoever said, let me see that doodle, let's blow it up, let's put it on the wall, it's beautiful. Some of the stuff each one of us created was gorgeous.
That's true.
I've looked down at some people's. Did you ever look at your old composition book? Do you have any? You have one sitting around? Old composition notebooks from when you were a kid. Now what you're going to see is a lot of anger. You see a lot of sharp edges. You're going to see a lot of stuff going and penetrating in it because you were bored. And you kind of, if maybe a male composition book. I don't know what the female composition books would show. What do they show? What did you doodle? What do girls doodle with in their books? They draw houses or?
Very often they draw
houses
and families,
right?
and trees.
Houses and families and trees, and we drew rocket ships,
the
grenades, guns, and I wonder what the difference is. Okay, anyway, but those are all creative moments. They're great.
Yes.
They're great. Now, I watch a home where there are people living at home, like in Stephanie Damra, one of our therapists, she has a home which is filled with creative kids. Everything is creative. She's got a girl who's dancing. She's got a son who's playing every instrument. She's got cousins who play music. She plays music. She's got all this stuff going on in her family. The family is endlessly filled with creative spunk. It's life.
That's That's wonderful.
It's right there. And then you could look at another home where it's completely stifled. You know, and a home of a stifled creativity is a home that is almost like a festering place for depression. It's almost like, let's grow some depression here. What do we do? Well, okay, first thing we've got to do is let's get rid of all the creativity. You see any over there? Oh, there's some creativity in the corner. Let's get rid of that. Throw it in the trash. There's a little up in the closet. Let's get rid of that. Get rid of the pens and the pencils. And we can't have any of that. We'll have the child watch television. Right? And this would be the best thing for their creative thing. Or we give them a video game, which has the edge of creativity to it, but it's redundant. But it's the same thing over and over again. You know? And I think sometimes taking a child somewhere where they could be creative somewhere in the world. I remember Ori Yemini Morrison once said to me, she said, when we were a child, we had no toys. They were poor. We had no toys. We had nothing to work with. She lived on a kibbutz. She said, so we drew in the sand with our feet. We would make drawings in the sand, and we would make these beautiful, elaborate drawings in the sand with our feet. And then the tide would eventually take them away, she said, but some of them were so beautiful that they just kind of filled my heart and lasted forever. And I thought that was a great image, because your creativity now is no longer just creativity for preservation of art, for keeping it in the future, for looking at it, but for the actual experience.
And I think that you need time. Children need time. They need boredom. You know, it's required for them to have nothing to do so that creativity can well up from within them rather than being handed to them from outside. And I find in my work with children, I can always tell the family, the home that doesn't have the creativity, and I can tell when all of the entertainment or all of the creativity is coming from outside them, because they need constant reinforcement. They need constant outside influence, because they haven't found that boredom, that place, that time where they have nothing, and so they're going to draw beautiful drawings in the sand. Children need that time. It's really important.
So wait, I want to get a little further with this boredom. How do you need boredom? I mean, does it grow from boredom?
If you have a video game or something that occupies all the time, there's no space. And I think creativity requires some empty space where there's nothing. And so that what can well up from within you is the creativity that comes from you. And that you discover that you have this hidden source. You have this hidden light, this hidden source of strength that you can draw upon. And if you don't have that, When you don't have something given to you from outside, you're lost. I see that a lot. So if children are given time and space and a kind of an emptiness, in other words, not such directed play, like a video is directed play, but just, you know, whatever's around them, the natural world or empty boxes. That's why kids play with empty boxes. It's such a cliche, but it's true, because it allows them to invent the play. And it's an incredibly creative act, and people should never underestimate the power of this in school, of art and music, because that kind of thinking, that kind of creative thinking, will serve you in every other aspect of your life. That ability to think outside the norm, to think outside the box, to kind of come up with ideas that aren't presented to you already packaged.
So what's a parent to do? Do you think a parent might look at how much structured their activity there is around and try to reduce it so you could leave a Oh, I just left those charcoals in that pad on the desk there. You could use them if you want, but I took away your video games.
I do think so. I do think that children should have some open time that's not, doesn't have play that's directed from outside of them. And I also think that they should be encouraged to, quote-unquote, make mistakes. They should be encouraged to explore without an end result expected. A lot of times parents, I find in workshops I do often, the parents are very concerned about the end product. The child is not concerned about the end product. They love the end product, but they love the process. They love the creative process. They want to throw paint around. They want to make a beautiful line. They want to make a messy line. Whatever it is, they love the process. And so the parents should allow for that process to unfold and not say, well, it should really look, you know, not to expect a finished product.
If people wanted to see your work, they could look at your website.
Yes.
Mere Arts.
No, it's patriciamiranda.com. Okay. www.patriciamiranda.com, and Miranda's MIRANDA.
And as opposed to?
A lot of people say M.A.
M.A. Miranda, right. It's
yeah,
Miranda.
It's Miranda.
Thank you, Miranda. And the you work both in, I know you also like to work in Gold Leaf. Just a couple of minutes. Would you tell me why Gold Leaf? What does Gold Leaf do to you, and how do you use it?
Okay. Gold, I use it, it's a part of my palette, I would say. It's almost like a color. But it's Gold Leaf is basically gold that's been hammered into super thin sheets. And again, the Egyptians are the first ones to do this. They gilded objects, and it makes the object look like it's made out of gold. But the thing that's unique about gold, well, there's many things, but one of the things in terms of thinking of gold as part of your palette is it has a reflective quality that it seems to hold light within itself. It seems to be lit from within, as opposed to a lot of other things. We put a light on them, they're the reflecting light back from another source. Gold seems to hold light within itself, and it's been used historically always for that reason. If you can imagine a time before electricity, now we have, our world is very overly lit, but if you can think of the impact of gold before we had electricity, it would be enormous. If you would walk into a temple or a mosque or a church where there's gold, the impact of that is extraordinary. It seems to glow from within. So that's one of the powerful things that I love about it.
And you work with that, and you'll work with the egg tempera at the same time. Those
yes.
are your two.
Those are two of my mediums, yeah.
And so do you, when you look at it, do you actually see gold coming off the page, or do you see a shiny spot?
You will see gold. It's both a color and also a reflective surface.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. So you have a class coming up, and if people want to get in touch with you, it's patriciamiranda.com. This is Armand DeMille, gifted. Gifted. I'm such a lucky guy. Gifted by Patricia Miranda. Who's,
thanks so much for having me, Armand.
Oh, Patricia, you're such a wonderful teacher. And there's so many people I've heard who talk about you and the work you've done and what you've meant to them. You know, I could do a lot of therapy with a lot of people, but when I see what you do, when you get your hands on somebody's creative spirit and unleash it, it's essential stuff.
Thanks.
So thanks for being with us. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to be back with you on, I'm going to be back with you on a Tuesday at 1 p.m. We have more treats planned for you, as you could tell. And again, homethemovie.com. You could come down and join us next Thursday at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And if you wanted a copy of today's program, or you wanted to hear today's program, or send it to somebody, you can go to thepositivemind.com, where we already have the interview with Sonny Rollins up for podcasting, my friends. Don't miss it. It was beautiful. Be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m.